funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can mainstream American culture be understood and even defined by studying those who consciously choose to live far outside its boundaries? For more than a decade, journalist Evan Wright's work has focused almost exclusively on people who exist outside the mainstream, whose values might shock, if not deeply offend, those of us who lead more conventional lives. So what can those stories tell us about the nature of culture and the benefits and the consequences of choosing a path most of us would never tread? Evan Wright is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair today, but his work has also been published in the New York Times, LA Times, Rolling Stone, and early in his career, Hustler magazine, where he served as film critic, which, yes, means exactly what you think. His new book of essays is called Hellenation, Looking for Happy Meals in Kandahar, Rocking the Side Pipe, Wing Nuts War Against the Gap, and Other Adventures with the Totally Lost Tribes of America. Evan, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You have said that you don't so much go far off Main Street to find your subjects as simply look a little more closely at who actually lives on Main Street. Will you talk about that?
Sure. I guess, you know, as a general concept, I grew up in the 70s and 80s when I came of age then. And I had this sense that, you know, I used to read about, like, the Wild West. In that time when America was this sort of crazy, lawless place filled with outlaws. And I thought that time was over, that, you know, I grew up in an era of, like, safety belt regulations and mini malls and, you know, anti-smoking initiatives. And it turns out, you know, as I became an adult and then a journalist, that I really think that our country is as lawless and wide open as it was 150 years ago, and, you know, it's both a good and a bad thing. So my work is really just about these people that don't fit into mainstream conceptions of who Americans are. So it really began at Hustler when I got a job there, sort of by accident. I was just unemployed and needed a job, and I found myself covering the porn industry. And, you know, Hustler was both a part of that industry and also was one of the few publications within it that would actually write critically about things that were going on, such as the failure to protect performers from HIV. So I spent a lot of time, I mean, the part of my job was like a joke, and we all laugh about it now, but part of it was also being immersed in this really bizarre subculture of all these people, you know, thousands of people who were concentrated in Southern California, who were just completely rejecting all social norms. And typically the women who perform in porn films were viewed, and I sort of had this conception, I was raised by, my mother was a feminist, she was an attorney, and I went to Vassar College, so I had this conception that all the women that were performing in the industry were, they were being exploited, and they were drug addicts and abused. And those were true for some of the women, but I also found there were these people that just, they didn't care what they were supposed to be doing, and they were committing, you know, these acts of almost aggression against social norms by performing on film. So that was my first exposure to this populace within America that was just different.
I have to imagine that it's hard for any American man to tell his mother that he's working at Hustler, let alone one with a feminist mother. Was it something that you initially had to find a way to sort of frame for yourself and for everyone else when you took the job?
You know, it wasn't. My mother thought it was. She was used to me by then, but you know, the strangest thing was when I was dating. You know, I was single, and for part of the time I worked there, and that was actually much harder to be on a date with somebody. And you know, you're trying to make your best presentation of who you are, and you know, well, what do you do? You know, I work at Hustler. That didn't always go over too well.
Would people be surprised at the normalness of other people who work there, or is it exactly what we imagine?
At Hustler itself?
Yeah.
You know, most of the people that worked there when I was there were writers or musicians and bands who just needed a job. There was a woman I worked with who was the editor of Chic magazine, and she once said, yeah, we're like people who work in a bank, you know, in that bankers are surrounded by money, but it's not really theirs. And I think that I think of my fellow workers there, I was the one who sort of took the most interest in the industry itself and spent a lot of time with the performers. I mean, I write in the introduction of Hell in Nation that when I started at Hustler, I was basically what people would define as an alcoholic. And I write about my first job interview where I basically overdosed on Xanax. And it was in that industry that I eventually went to a 12-step program and turned my life around. And that sort of was the dawn of my other reporting. But I was going to 12-step meetings with porn performers, like women, porn stars who were also sober. And so I just had a very different take on everything that was going on around me.
Do you feel like during that time in your career that you essentially traded an addiction to alcohol and drugs for one in which you're sort of addicted to working?
I don't know. You know, the truth is, even when I was a drunk, I would drink hard and work hard. I think I then went on to write about combat and go to war and stuff. And I heard this fellow journalist who got sober, and he would say, now we're doing this other addiction thing. And I don't know if that's true. I think that what is true is that if you've lived as an alcoholic or addict, you're very accustomed to a certain level of chaos, even if it's just internal. And so I felt when I was covering the porn industry or I've done other crazy stories that I was able to manage the stress because I had managed so much stress previously in my addiction phase.
And one thing that comes through is that you are able to identify with people who feel as if no one else understands them, even if you don't fully understand why they think the way they think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in part that's it's a function of my, problem that I overcame I think I was always that way, even when I was, actually my mother was a very open-minded person, and I think that I got some of that from her, and she was an attorney who represented, she did defense work, and so a lot of her clients were people that were guilty of something, and I think she had a lot of empathy for them, and I think that the other thing I learned from her was when she was defending someone who was guilty, she would say, well, I'm not defending the person or the act. I'm defending the process. And I feel as a journalist that I, too, have a role in the process. So when I did the story on neo-Nazis, I felt the process of journalism was to give them a voice. And I thought that I was very worried about that, but I thought that that would give them, that would be more damning than any sort of editorializing I would do, just to let them speak. And I thought that would be a more effective way to sort of skewer them. So I think, some of it's like my recovery background, but some of it's just how I was raised.
I have to tell you, that chapter is probably the most disturbing in the book. They're all fascinating, but it really just sort of draws you in. Can you talk first about the kinds of rules that you set up for yourself before you went to spend a great deal of time with these neo-Nazis?
Sure. That was the first real piece of journalism I had done. ironically, I think years earlier, I had done one little story where I interviewed Chief Buthelezi, the former king of the Zulus from South Africa. So I went from him, and that was just a minor story, to years later, I went to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, to spend time with the neo-Nazis of the Aryan Nation. And I had pitched that story. You know, Hustler would do one serious story a month. Often they weren't that good, as people would imagine. And I pitched it to Larry Flint, who had been shot, he believed, by a white supremacist. And so he assigned the story, and then I had this assignment, and then I really didn't know what to do. So as I really, on the road to Coeur d'Alene, or, you know, I flew in somewhere and rented a car with a photographer, I sort of made up the rules as we approached the guardhouse. And the rules that I thought were fair would be to identify myself as a reporter and that was the most important one, because there's this notion that reporters should go undercover and, like, trick people. And I think it's actually better if you're up front and you tell them who you are, what you're doing. And if you disagree with them, you tell them that. So initially that didn't work with the neo-Nazis. You know, we approached them and said we're going to do a story on them, and they turned us away. So I hung out in there's a nearby town to where this compound was, and just waited until I saw some. Luckily, neo-Nazis are easily identifiable on the street.
Skinheads and tattoos and what we might imagine.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, just look for the swastikas, and they were, like, at the 7-Eleven buying something.
Wow.
And I started talking. And that was, so my basic rule is really simple. Tell them what I'm doing. And what I found is if you give a story enough time, people will eventually talk.
Yeah, it's really remarkable how once you got onto the little compound area, how open people seem to have been with you about their beliefs, even knowing that you were an outsider.
Right. And I think it's this human thing because, again, it's kind of subtle, but I had had this conception before I went on, like, oh, maybe I should say I'm a reporter, but I completely agree with your cause, and so tell me, you know, we're brothers and sisters in this crazy cause. And I actually wasn't comfortable. I wouldn't have been comfortable saying that with the Nazis. But what I found is by going on and saying, hey, you guys are really, I was kind of gentle about it, but, you know, your beliefs are just really different. And a lot of people think they're reprehensible. And what I found is that when I sort of laid it out there like that, they would then sort of explain themselves to me. And that was a much more effective way. The other thing I found in covering the military, I'm jumping ahead here, if that's okay.
Sure.
Is a few years later, I arrived in Afghanistan to cover the 101st Airborne, and I had this sense that by then I'd been writing for Rolling Stone for a few years, but I felt inferior to other reporters. And I had to find means to overcome that. So it's kind of an involved story. Maybe we can pick it up.
Yes. Thank you for hearing the break music. Yes, we will take a quick break. Evan Wright is my guest. His new book is called Helen Nation. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Evan Wright. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His new book is called Hellenation, Looking for Happy Meals in Kandahar, Rocking the Sidepipe, Wingnut's War Against the Gap, and Other Adventures with the Totally Lost Tribes of America. If you want to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. So you were saying, Evan, that when you got to Kandahar, you had to sort of figure a way to have some confidence in your own abilities as a journalist.
Yeah, I was surrounded by reporters from, like, the New York Times and these publications that I sort of felt like, well, these guys really know what they're doing. And there were two things that happened. The first is I observed other reporters at work, and what I saw, it's a very human response. We always like to show how smart we are, and so reporters would meet with military guys, and the military guy would have some unusual piece of technology or a gun or something, and he would start to say, like, what his thing did. You know, this gun does this, and the reporter would sort of cut him off and say, oh, I'm familiar with that, I wrote about that. And what I found is it's better to be ignorant in your stories, and to, even if you think you know something, to always let your subjects explain to you what they're doing and what they have. I think you get a much better story that way if you start off from a position of ignorance, and I'm good at that. The other funny thing is with the military is I'd always had this sense of embarrassment, not totally, but social embarrassment that I'd worked at Hustler. And
not
found,
there.
But the Army guys, yeah, it was like, you know, if you were from the New York Times, big deal. But if you had were formerly from Hustler, everybody sort of was like, that's great, man, come with my unit, and we can talk about porn stars. So it turned out to be a big advantage.
And you, when we talk about alienation as sort of a theme in the book, these guys were really concerned that nobody cared what they were up to.
Yes, and very prescient concern, too, because at the time, early on, the country was still interested in the war, but they already had the sense that it was sort of falling off, the interest. And, of course, interestingly, 5 years later, I was in Baghdad in 2007, and I ran into one of the guys I'd profiled in the piece that's in Hellenation. And, you know, he was still serving. And by then, of course, I think the country had pretty much lost interest in, to a great extent, in what the soldiers were doing and who they were. But, you know, one thing I found in covering the military and sort of with the theme of outsiders is that the guys and the women, but I've mostly written about men in the military because I've covered the combat units where there are no women. So I can say the guys in the military that I've written about, they're sort of rejectionists. That's a term I use for a lot of Americans who sort of have turned their back on the sort of the dominant expectations of what they should be. And a lot of the people in the military fit into that. They're kids. They're young men who grew up, you know, in this sort of like MTV reality world view of what they should be, like, you know, going to Cabo and spring break and wild times at the beach. And they decided very thoughtfully that they didn't want to be a part of that. And they wanted to join the military to be totally different than their peers in their generation. And it's interesting because the media tends to depict people in the military as like socioeconomic losers who were tricked into joining because of unscrupulous recruiters.
Right, like who would do this if they had a choice?
Right. And actually, a lot of the people in the combat units are there because they want to be there. And they're not there because they're bloodthirsty killers. They wanted to do something different than everybody else. And they wanted to do something that was like selfless and heroic. Now, that's not a comment on, you know, the wars that they're fighting, but in their minds, that's what they wanted to do. And it's really striking, and it comes across a little bit, you know, in that one piece in Hellenation. where they talk about the care they felt for the Afghans that they were patrolling, but really didn't understand them at all at the same time.
Well, the amazing thing, and I like that you use in the longest subtitle I've ever said on the show, probably, the word tribes, because in every single chapter, as very outside the mainstream as these people seem, they all seem to not only find a tribe, but absolutely need one. No matter how far outside the mainstream they are, you get the sense that everybody needs someone who gets them.
Yeah. It's... And again, it's good and bad. I mean, there's there's a story in there, The Bad American, where it's a very convoluted story about this crime in Phoenix that involved these young men that were selling human growth hormone online and then committed a robbery and recruited. There was one of these guys, The Bad American, in my story, impersonated a CIA agent and recruited Russian immigrants to do nefarious acts, and he had Russian girls that he talked into dancing at strip clubs, and then he would take their money. And it was just one of the most insane stories I've ever written about. But what was interesting, again, I always see this, is that he was at the center of this little universe he had created, and a lot of different people belonged to it, and they started to create their own sort of rules and perceptions of reality. And I guess it's just a very normal human occurrence. And I find it interesting because I always go back to the idea that if you watch television, as we all do, in our entertainment and news, television sort of presents this concept of a very unified, homogenous society. And even when people are doing something different on TV, they're sort of co-opted. But what I find is that that's a false reality. I mean, really, among real Americans, we're still a very strange people.
An email from Jeff in Dallas wants to know about your title. What does Hella mean?
Well, my title, I should be very upfront to all people that use the term Hella, is somewhat of a misuse of the term Hella. Hella really means, like, totally.
Extremely, very.
Extremely, very. And I really wanted the title Hella America, and that didn't work for a variety of reasons. So we went with Hella Nation. So it's really a nonsense title, to be honest.
Did you have to fight for that? Because I think I know every interview that you've done about this book, people have asked that almost first off. What does that mean?
No, it's I actually, this happened with my last book, Generation Kill. I sometimes will propose a title in jest, and then the publisher says, "That sounds really good. Let's use that." And so they liked it. The long subtitle was, again, something somewhat of a joke, but it worked out.
I have to say, I really liked the chapter, much to my surprise, on the guys from Motley Crue, in part because I guess my assumption was that their public personas must be almost entirely an act. But based on your observations, what fans are seeing on stage reflects a pretty genuine picture of the lives they live off stage.
Yeah, that was really strange for me to spend that time with them. And this was a few years ago. But they were, like, in a psychological sense, they were completely, like, well-integrated human beings because they really were, as they appear, they were basically like 14-year-old boys mentally who had like all the powers of adults and celebrities. It was sort of magical and twisted and gross at the same time.
Well, it's fascinating even that they, they've got all the money in the world, but they drive through Taco Bell and you write, I don't know if it's Vince Neil or somebody, hands out everybody else's taco before he takes his own, including to the crew and other folks.
Yeah. No, they had this sort of brotherhood of the road. What was even funnier though, is that we were in this town, where the the owner of the best restaurant in the city had offered to open it up, and like the chef would personally cook for them, and they're like, no, dude, let's go to Taco Bell.
Did you have a sense, you know, you say Brotherhood of the Road. Did you have a sense that they're all sort of performing, if not for you, maybe for each other, when they're in this really intense environment of traveling and touring with each other, and that maybe they are somewhat different when they're home with the kids?
Sure. But I think that's what guys do in general. When you have a group of guys, I think that they perform for each other and immediately take on the roles of, like, the clown, the angry one, whatever it is. I think that's a very male thing.
How important is it to you that you like someone that you're going to profile?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I would prefer to like the person I'm profiling, and I think I've turned down stories because I totally just didn't think I would like the person. But at the same time, sometimes, my form of liking is often a very sort of like tenuous thing, because sometimes it's a person that's, you know, reprehensible. But for instance, the guy, the bad American, you know, he was suspected of killing somebody, of ordering the death of somebody in a very terrible way. And this is the guy in Phoenix that I'd profiled, who was
right.
involved in all these nefarious things. But I spent like a few days with him. I finally, he was free. And, you know, we drove around with his kids. He had young children, and he was trying to have this like life with them. And then we went to the fish store. He was like a exotic fish collector. And I found myself really liking him. And I guess I try to have this objectivity, because what I was really trying to sense was this guy was a con artist, and he functioned by gaining people's confidence and trust. And so I allowed myself to sort of go through that experience with him just to understand how he preyed on people. So this sounds very convoluted, but I guess like in my stories, I feel like I will use my human emotions of friendship and trust almost to experience the story.
How hard is it after that to then turn around and write, maybe the word is mercilessly, about everything that you've observed about someone?
Yeah, there was a reporter from the New York Times, Sharon Waxman, who once told me that, and she was quoting somebody else, so I don't know where this came from, that a reporter's duty was to charm and betray. And when I've written, at times I feel like, you know, it's a betrayal. Whether or not I'm saying anything negative, it's just, even if you write about somebody, it's awkward, you know, if you've come to know them well. So it's a hard process for me. Especially, you know, with criminals, it's not as hard. But, you know, with other subjects, it's more difficult. There's a profile of Tito Ortiz in Hell and Nation, the Ultimate Fighter. He was the champion for a while. And
we should tell people Ultimate Fighting is sort of literally no holds barred kind of hand-to-hand combat.
Yes, and it's done, it's become really popular. By the way, as an aside, when you write a magazine article, and that story began purely as a magazine article, there's this thing that editors do or have you do, and you sort of have to proclaim that your topic is very important and timely, even if it isn't. So in that UFC article about the Ultimate Fighters, it was written a few years ago when Ultimate Fighting wasn't that popular. So I found some guy and I quoted him, and I said, and he said, you know, Ultimate Fighting will become more popular than everything else, you know, wrestling, boxing. And I quoted that really to satisfy my editor, and I didn't really think this would be the case, but it turned out that the UFC has become extremely popular. So my story called that one. But the point is that when I wrote about Tito, the Ultimate Fighter, I found a person he'd worked with, and Tito, it turned out, had created this image. And very consciously, he developed how he would become a celebrity. So he trained as a fighter, but he also acquired a look, like these, he wore flames on his shorts and dyed his hair and had this like crazy look. And when I put that in the story, Tito felt very betrayed that I had revealed his secret. And I thought it made the story much better, but you know, he personally felt like, how could you do that to me? So you encounter that all the time.
Well, it's an interesting detail because I think it causes you to step back and think about the extent to which we all create ourselves. You know, people talk a lot about finding themselves, but I wonder how much is finding and how much is deciding what we're going to be.
That's actually a really cool way of looking at it. Because this big theme of all the people I write about, you know, basically everyone I've written about is like they've run away from something. Whether they're literal teen runaways or they're running away from their old lives, and they reinvent themselves. But I never thought that that's what people mean by finding themselves.
Have you found a way to explain why people who live entirely within the mainstream are so fascinated by these people?
I think it's sometimes it's fear. Because some of the people I write about are scary. And I think people are interested in what they're afraid of.
Evan Wright is my guest. He's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. His new book is called Hellenation, Looking for Happy Meals in Kandahar, Rocking the Sidepipe, Wingnuts War Against the Gap, and Other Adventures with the Totally Lost Tribes of America. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Vanity Fair contributing editor Evan Wright is my guest. His new book is called Hellenation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. The fear thing is very interesting to me, Evan, and you write in the book that you found that the closer you get to things that frighten you, the less power they hold.
Yes, that's true, and it really started with that first story on the neo-Nazis in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, the Aryan Nations, simply because when I actually got into their little subculture and listened to them, I discovered that they were just really deeply confused, frightened people. And they're dangerous, yes. I mean, after I did that story, some of the people I had interviewed actually committed some crimes and hurt some people. But I find that understanding things that are, people that are frightening sort of diminishes my own fear of them.
What's really strange in those situations is that you're also then able to witness them in moments of normalcy and of courtesy to each other. And that has to be a strange thing to get your head around, because we want to think of people, particularly neo-Nazis, as just entirely separate from anything we could conceive.
Yeah, there were mothers there with their children. They're like toddlers, you know, and they were talking about how the care they take to raise their children. And, you know, it was really, I mean, it was bizarre and almost more disturbing to see how normal they were, you know. And they also had this sense of righteousness that that they were on this sort of path of righteousness, and the rest of the country had gone to perdition because of its embrace of multiculturalism.
Were you able to get a handle on the source of the hatred?
The source of the hatred, I think, and this is sort of speculating based on talking to them, I found that a lot of them did not have any direct experience interacting with black people or Jews, the prime targets. And so I wondered if their hatred was definitely based on fear, but it wasn't fear from direct knowledge. So it almost seemed completely irrational.
Another chapter, Evan, that really caught my attention was the very last one in the book about this guy, Pat Dollard. And what really strikes you about him, and you can give us a little background on him in a minute, is that he's pretty clearly crazy, but because he has had association with all these famous people, he gets a bully pulpit.
Yeah. Pat was he was a Hollywood manager and agent. He started off at a young age. He had an older sister who had been very successful, who died tragically, and Pat sort of took over her agenting business and actually then took it to a new level. And he represented his most well-known client was Steven Soderbergh, the director of Traffic and the Ocean's films. And Pat was a terrible drug addict, and he was locked up in mental hospitals a few times when he was picked up in L.A. just running around crazy. And so by the time I met him, he'd been an agent for about 15 years, and he was undergoing this transformation where he wanted to become he'd been a sort of an ultra-liberal, and he had rejected all of this to become a militant supporter of then-President George Bush. That was all fine, but Pat was doing this at a time when he was still sort of leading this crazy lifestyle and sometimes wrestling with sobriety. And eventually, like I said, I write about runaways, he ran off to Iraq and tried to make a pro-war documentary and was blown up and actually did things that were quite heroic. But throughout all of this, he kept flying off the rails, and I think the story goes into that.
You focused your academic career on the study of history as embraced by the Annales School, which essentially argues that what matters rather than the outcome is the investigation itself. Can you talk about how that informs your work now?
Sure. In that school of thought, this French historian sort of came up with it. Funny how the French always come up with theories that we then embrace. But this was a pretty cool French theory because it wasn't all that complicated. Previously historians would go into work with sort of these preconceived ideas and then try to like fulfill those notions with what they found. And the Annales historians just really focused on the nitty-gritty of trying to figure things out. Classic Annales case is the Vikings landed in Britain, and there was this big debate. Did the Vikings just like loot and pillage, or did they farm? And some Annales historians came up with this idea, well, let's find out if there's words in the English language that come from Norse that apply to agriculture. And this would then serve as evidence that the Vikings were actually farming. Now, that's a really complicated thing, but as a reporter, I sort of took that school of thought, and I just try to gather as much data about people as I can, and then often not really write about them or draw conclusions, just sort of lay it out there. So, for instance, with the story you brought up of Pat Dollard, you frame the question as, like, the guy's crazy. I don't think I ever state in the story that he's crazy.
That's my inference also.
Exactly. But I sort of try to avoid ever saying, even if it's like obvious, I just want the story to speak for itself. I try to lay out as many facts as I can and let the story speak.
How do you sort of collect and process all these tiny little minute details as you're reporting and researching your stories?
I'm a big believer in written notes and recordings. I don't really believe in video. I don't like video news. And I say that because a lot of people have asked me, well, hey, why don't you carry a video camera? I think that video cameras they create a truth that's less true than the written word at times.
Is that because they intensify people's reactions based on their presence?
That, and also video is like a form of tunnel vision. Like, it focuses on one thing and really excludes everything else. And plus, like, words are a more efficient way of giving information. I don't care if, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. I don't believe that. But anyway, I just try to gather as much and put it all together, and it's a big struggle when I write a story.
I'm not disagreeing with what you have to say about video, but I wonder why you think writing doesn't or isn't susceptible to the same thing, that you ultimately focus on something to the exclusion of something else.
Of course, that's a big problem. And what I really believe is you need both. But the example I always think of is I have a story, Wingnut's War Against the Gap, it's about the radical anarchists. And the origins of the story were there was the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, and a bunch of anarchists threw bricks at windows of Gaps and other chain stores. And those images were picked up by the news services and played over and over again on television. And people were sort of saturated with this idea of kids in black smashing these windows. And what happens with video news, and it's a big problem in our country, is it creates its sort of own narrative and its own truth, and people feel that they're experts on it based on looking at an image. What I found is that in the Seattle riots, which I covered, the first rioting occurred by the police, and ironically, the police, their overreaction then enabled the anarchists in that chaos to go out and smash the windows. And the second thing I discovered is that the anarchists who are portrayed on TV as sort of these, like, wild hippies actually subscribed to, they were followers of the Unabomber. And they weren't just, like, environmentalists. They actually want to sort of have this revolution and turn the country back to the Stone Age. So I felt in that story I was sort of working against the news, the television news narrative that was created. So you need both, and you need both written and televised news, and they need it's healthy for them to work against each other.
And was this the story, by the way, where you had pitched it to an editor and they said, "Nah, we don't care about this," but then suddenly there were images on screen that told them, "Oh, this must be an important story."
Yeah, very, very unhealthy thing. I did pitch that story initially when a bunch of, like, tens of thousands of peaceful protesters, they're going to dress up in, like, turtle costumes and, like, march against World Trade, and nobody was interested. It wasn't until the anarchists were filmed smashing windows that it became a story. And it was interesting because the anarchists, when they were asked, "Why did you do this?" They said, "Well, because to get the media's attention." And it was very hard as a member of the media to say, "Actually, you guys were right. It worked."
Do you think the rest of us who sort of embrace or at least live easily within the mainstream make a choice as conscious as that of those who live outside of it?
No, that's a really good question. I think the one thing I find commendable about people, even the anarchists, like the guy I profiled, Wingnut, he follows the Unabomber. I mean, I really think it's a terrible thing. But I find this commendable thing in rebels, which is that they've consciously chosen to do something that's difficult. And that part of what they do, I often respect. Often what follows is a lot of stuff that I don't respect. But I do respect that conscious choice. And I think, when you reject the dominant paradigm, you almost have to do it consciously.
We have an email from Preston in Weatherford who wants to know about your transition from writing for Hustler to writing for Today, Vanity Fair.
The one thing is that when I worked at Hustler, I would call magazines in New York and want to talk to the editors. And what I found is that the editors would always talk to me because they're really curious about, like, you know, what's it like working at Hustler? So I could always get in the door with that. And then it was a much harder sell to have them hire me to write something that was mainstream.
Would people be surprised? Is there the same sort of, you know, Dilbert office politics at a place like Hustler that there is at any other magazine?
Completely. Yeah, it was very much the same. And the one thing about Flint is he had good health benefits.
Well, I guess he could relate to the need for them. So what do you think is the consequence of never stepping outside the mainstream and never sort of risking social acceptance by doing something really far out?
Well, I think the worst consequence, it's not bad to stay in the mainstream. I mean, my stories don't make an argument that people should be doing what my subjects are doing.
Right,
they certainly
right.
don't. But I think it's important to step out a little bit just to get perspective on you know, where you are in society, because you can't see what you're doing unless you step outside and look at it from a distance through other people's eyes.
I know that you're writing your next book about, it's a memoir of some time that you spent in a boys' school. Is that right?
Yeah. Part of the reason I love writing about runaways and identity issues is that when I was a little kid, 12, 13 years old, I was this total rebel and was kicked out of school and ran away and wound up in this home for like problem kids. And they used very draconian techniques to try to straighten us out. And I went back and interviewed people that had been through that experience, that same program with me, and the people that ran it. And I'm writing I call it a reported memoir, because there's so many people that have recently written fraudulent memoirs. So I use actual quotes and real sources in addition to my own recollections.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as a rebel today?
No, I, you know, no, I try not to, you know, I try to fit in. It's funny, I do all these crazy stories and, like, we'll go to war zones and stuff, and then I come home and try to have a normal life.
Evan Wright is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. His new book is called Hellenation. Evan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.